أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا وحبيبنا حبيب إله العالمين محمد، اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين. The principles of interacting with the world are 7. Ar-ridha bid-dun, being content with what is available. Wal-itharu bil-mujood, even giving away what is available. Wa-tarku talab al-mafqood, abandoning the futile quest for the elusive. وَبُغْضُ الْكَسْرَةِ, hating overabundance. وَاخْتِيَارُ الزُّهْدِ, choosing abstinence. وَمَعْرِفَةُ آفَاتِهَا, knowing the evils of this world. وَرَفْضُ شَهَوَاتِهَا مَعَ رَفْضِ الرِّئَاسَةِ, abandoning the desires, the deceptive desires of this world, and negating dominance. Now, these 7, of course, need to be explained. Our attitude towards this dunya is probably the root of all our actions in this world. The other 3 aspects that we discussed during the previous nights, our interaction with God, our interaction with ourselves, our interaction with people, are all affected by the way we look at this dunya, the way we take it. And therefore it's very important to understand, first of all, what is dunya, and secondly, what sort of attitude we should have towards it. You know that in the word of the Quran and in the words of the Prophet and Imam Ali Musallam, we have huge condemnation of this world. And then we ponder, if this world is condemned so much by God, then why he has put us in such an environment, and why everyone is vying for this world? Why shouldn't we just abandon what makes our attachment to outside and live in caves and do worship all the time? So this arranging, organizing this relationship with dunya is very important. Dunya can be very elusive, as the Quran mentions, Al-gharur, something which deceives continuously. Why? Why should dunya deceive us? If it is like that, why God has created it? And why has put us in this furnace of world to burn the way, of course, we are? Why? The book I have suggested for extra reading by Faiza Kashani, in that book there is a huge chapter in which he slams dunya, condemns it the way Amirul Mu'minin condemns it in Nahjul Balagha, for example. But before that, he does something that I haven't seen in other books, and this shows how clever this man was. First, he says, let me define dunya, and then I bash it. Then I slam it. So that you know what am I talking about? What am I condemning? What am I attacking? It's very important, because the source of all confusion is when we talk about dunya, we don't know what does that mean. Would the food that we eat, is it part of dunya or not? We love our family. Is it part of dunya or not? We love to have money to spend. Is it part of dunya or not? If it's part of dunya, why we are encouraged, for example, to look after our family? And if it's not, what is it? Now, very interestingly, Faiz al-Kashani says dunya and akhirah are two states of heart. Very clever. It's not what is outside. It's not money. It's not wealth. It is the state of your heart which makes something dunya or akhirah. If Umar ibn Sa'd attacks Hussein alayhi salam because he was tempted by the promise of the governorship of Persia, this is certainly dunya. But if Malik Ashtar is sent to Egypt to rule that huge territory and civilization, given the decree and authorization by Amirul Mu'mineen, that is akhirah. Both are the same thing. He wants to rule Persia, and Malik Ashtar wants to rule Egypt. But with two different states of heart. Now, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in a hadith which clarifies the situation, our situation with regards to dunya, very beautifully explains for us what do we mean by dunya when we talk about dunya, when we say you have to abandon dunya. He says, "Ad-dunya, dunya'an." When we talk about dunya, we don't talk about one dunya. We talk about two dunya. And this is the inspiration for Faiz al-Kashani, saying that it's a state of heart. It's not really what's outside. It's the state of your heart. Ad-dunya, dunya'an. Dunya balaghin wa dunya mal'una. There's one dunya, which is provision. Without it, you cannot live. Without it, you cannot attain akhirah. Ad-dunya mazra'atul akhirah. Okay, can Umar ibn Sa'd say, doesn't we have in our wisdom taught to us that ad-dunya mazra'atul akhirah, dunya is the harvest for akhirah, is the farm for akhirah, so I want Persia in my dunya? No. We have two dunya, ad-dunya, dunya'an. One dunya is provision. The other dunya is cursed, dunya mal'una. Okay, which one is which? What dunya is cursed? What dunya is condemned? Those of you who are familiar with Nahj al-Balagha know how Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam condemns dunya and advises to zuhd and abstinence, which we have to talk, what does that mean? Because that has also confused many people. So, but what dunya? He's talking about dunya mal'una, the cursed dunya. Not dunya balagh. What is dunya balagh? What is dunya mal'una? Now, it is for every religious person who has some wisdom from the Book of God. You know, we usually look for wisdom. What we lack in our modern world is not knowledge, is not science, is not technology, is not facilities, is not wealth. I don't think the human being can have ever been able to exploit the earth and to bring out its wealth and its bounties, blessings, to the extent that we are doing today. We don't lack money, we don't lack wealth. What we lack is wisdom. How to use these things. How to use our life while we are provided by all these things. Now, okay, for wisdom, we have, of course, to go to the Quran. We have to go to the words of the awliya Allah, they give us wisdom. Dunya balagh is the dunya which prepares you for akhirah. Is the dunya which is your means. And this means is praised in the Quran. This is blessing of God. This means is praised by the Prophet, peace be on him, by A'imma alayhimus salam. And this means is something that we have to thank God for giving it to us. Without dunya, how can we progress? How can we live? How can we have health? How can we provide for our families? As a means. But this dunya taken as an end in itself is mal'una, is cursed. Why cursed? Because it confuses us, it deceives us. It pretends that this is what we have to spend our souls upon. This is dunya mal'una. And this is what Allah is mentioning in the Quran. Both in Surah Fatir, in Surah Luqman, the same exact expression. Inna wa'ada Allahi haqq. The promise of God is true. Do not take it easy. Do not take it with radical and as a joke that you are going to be raised after death. You are moving towards a destination. God has not created you in vain. This is true. Inna wa'ada Allahi haqq. What makes you to think that it's not true? Dunya. فَلَا تَغُرَّنَّكُمُ الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا. Beware that the life of this world would not deceive you. It deceives. It deceives. Why it deceives? Because you take it as an end in itself. It deceives you. فَلَا تَغُرَّنَّكُمُ الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا وَلَا يَغُرَّنَّكُمْ بِاللَّهِ الْغَرُورِ. This is gharur. This is so deceptive. And you see, this is true, isn't it? So deceptive. Majority of us are deceived. We take it as an end. We think this is the whole life. This is what we are created for. And it becomes dunya mal'una. Well, naturally, it's cursed. It's cursed because we are cursed by it. Because we don't believe into a destination. We don't believe in akhirah. Believing in akhirah means believing that God has not created us in vain. Believing in akhirah means that God has a purpose. Thinking that it's only this world means that God has no purpose. Na'udhu billah, idiotly has created us. We come to this world for a while, live for a while, and go, and nothing else. There's no purpose. This is cursed dunya. So, when Imam alayhi salam says, dunya balaghin wa dunya mal'una, you can now imagine for yourself, whatever in this world you use, millions or billions or whatever, as a means for akhirah, it is good. It is khair. As the Quran says, it's khair, it's very good. Ni'mal awn ala taqwa al-ghina. What a good support is for taqwa, the wealth. To be rich is good for taqwa, provided you don't take it as an end, it's only a means. If $1, £1, or whatever in this world is taken as an end in itself, then it's mal'una. Whatever. So, the question is not how much we have, how much we spend, how we live our lives. The question is, what is our attitude? As Faiz-e Kashani says, what is our state of heart towards what we are using? It makes it balagh, it makes it maluna. Dunya balagh wa dunya maluna. So dunya maluna deceives. This is what Allah says. فَلَا تَغُرَّنَّكُمُ الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا. Dunya balagh will take you to your destination. سَخَّرَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ. Whatever is in heavens and earth is created for you. I have seen some people who are absolutely immersed in dunya mal'una, they quote these verses. Doesn't God say that whatever is in heaven and earth created for us, so we have to use it? Yes, we have to use it. But with what attitude of heart? As an end or as a means? Now, I don't think there is any dispute among the believers. Because, you know, always Quran says, وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ يُوقِنُونَ. Those who will prosper are those who believe certainly in Akhirah. Means what? Means they believe that there's a purpose in life. أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا. What injustice we do to God. Do you think we have created you in vain? How do you think about us? وَمَا قَدَرُ اللَّهِ حَقَّ قَدْرِهِ. They cannot measure God the way he should be measured. They do not give the weight that God should be given when they say that, well, it's only this world. There's no Akhirah. There's nothing. أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا وَأَنَّكُمْ إِلَيْنَا لَا تُرْجَعُونَ. And you do not come back to us. And you see the purpose. Sometimes people ask, when we die, in Barzakh or in Akhirah, is there any purpose? What's the purpose? My answer is always that this world doesn't have any purpose. In this world, we are just playing around. We don't have real purpose, just like play. This is what Allah says. إِنَّمَا هَذِهِ الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا لَهْوٌ وَلَعِبٌ. إِنَّمَا الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا لَهْوٌ وَلَعِبٌ. This world is play and sport. You don't have any purpose. What is the purpose? I want to study, to educate myself, to grow, to work for society. Okay, you know, all this society that we are working for, in 100 years, no one person of this society would be alive, including ourselves. What's the purpose? There is no purpose in this world except using it for something which has a purpose. وَإِنَّ الدَّارَ الْآخِرَةَ لَحْيَا الْحَيَوَانِ. The life you will find in Akhirah. The purpose you see, the purpose of your existence you see in Akhirah, not in this world. And that's why those people who are more intelligent and don't believe in Akhirah, they kill themselves. Yeah. What's this? Why? Why should I go through all these agonies and hardship? For what reason? If they don't believe in a purpose, in a higher purpose. So, the emphasis of the Quran on this issue, that you have to believe in a higher purpose. Otherwise, you cannot conduct your life correctly. قالوا لم نكن من المصلين ولم نكن نطعم المسكين وكنا نخوض مع الخائضين. The verses I mentioned last night, وكنا نكذب بيوم الدين. When there is this conversation between the people of paradise and hell, they say, what made you to go to hell? One of these is, we were denying that there was a purpose. There was a day of judgment. We were denying it. So is there? Because that would actually define how we use this dunya. This dunya as a means to it. Now let me tell you one very interesting thing. How this dunya would help us towards Akhirah? How? Kashani rahmatullah alayhi, again in that book is closely related to my topic actually. That's why I'm quoting it again and again. He says, three things we take with ourselves with this world, our souls. You know, we know that we cannot take real estate with us, isn't it? We cannot take it. We cannot take money with us. We cannot take property with us. We cannot take our children with us. God forbid, we don't want to take them with us, actually, when we die, do we? Anyhow, we cannot take anything with us. He says three things we take with ourselves, three things. One, and all these are actually facilitated by dunya balagh, by the world which we take as a means, not as an end. Now, what are those three things? First is purity of heart. The purer the heart, the more our capital in that world. How the heart is purified by practice, by action. We have helped people, we have given charity, we have done worship, we have done the heart is purified. And this purity of the heart we take, of course, the actions that we do, we will see. It's all accumulated in our hearts. We will see in that world. But tell me, have you ever thought, for example, you give charity. How do you see it in that world? How do you see it? In what form? In what shape? You have been honest. Of course, honesty has a reward. Now, there are certain Muslim philosophers and exegetes who believe that what we see in the next world is not, although it's called a reward because it's all done by God, but it's not a conventional reward. It is our actions being given back to us. We see our actions. يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وَمَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ سُوءٍ. The day when every soul will see whatever they have done in terms of evil or good, they see it in front of their eyes. It's there. And they say, this is your actions. And actually, when Allah says, He will raise you, فَيُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ. He informs you what you were doing. Does that mean that He says, okay, sit down, let me tell you what you would know? Our actions are given back to us. اقرأ كتابك, read your book. And book, our book is not a written book. It's compilation of our actions, compiled together. اقرأ كتابك, read your book. كفى بنفسك اليوم عليك حسيبا. You judge, you tell what should I do. You judge, you tell what should I do. It said that certain people on the day of judgment, they don't wait for judgment of Allah. They say, please let us go towards hell now. We cannot stand here anymore before you. Standing in that position, ashamed of what we have done, is more painful than fire of hell. Anyhow, how these actions do we see them? How do you see your salat? How do you see your khums, your zakat you are given? How do you see them? What form? Well, of course, it cannot be in this form. For every act that we do, there is an image, a form in Barzakh. There is an image and form in Akhirah. In the day of judgment, in hell, in paradise, there's a form. Let me give you an example. This room now is full of wave frequencies, isn't it? It is, of course. It's there. You don't feel anything, but it's there. Now, if you have an audio receiver, which can be tuned to these frequencies, you hear intelligible things, intelligible voice. If you have a video receiver and you can tune to these waves, you see images, things which are happening. These waves, if you want even to depict them, are very different from what you see on your screen, very different. But what you see on your screen, it makes sense what you probably sense or depict, what you can depict from these waves don't make sense. It's the same thing. We don't have receivers to see the form of our actions, honesty, charitable heart. We cannot see it. But when we die, we have that audio receiver, one level, of course, lower. We see, oh, this makes sense. It's either a very hurting sound which pierces our eardrums, or it's a very pleasant sound, something very nice. Then we go to Akhirah. These actions which were in waveforms, we did not see them. This is just an example. We see them in very pleasant pictures or very unpleasant pictures. We see them. This is how our actions come back to us. And these actions come back to us because our actions depend on our purity of heart. How evil the heart would be, or how good the heart would be, how benevolent it would be. These actions come back to us. And we see them, we enjoy them, or we detest them. We detest our actions. What do we really detest? We detest ourselves. We hate ourselves. And that's why the Prophet says, peace be on him, when you die, you see a person buried with you in your grave. And this person is hateful, is detestable. You cannot hate anything in this world more than this person. And you say, who are you? Why are you here? He said, I am your actions. I am with you. I'm not going to leave you. Or you see the most beautiful, handsome, lovable person coming with you. You feel, oh my God, am I going to be with this in my grave until the day of resurrection? Yes, who are you? I have your actions. I'm with you. Now, these are the waves in the air, which were in the air, now coming together. Of course, it's not like physical person, and many of these are examples given to us. Now, there is this verse in Surah Baqarah about paradise, which has perplexed many exegetes. كُلَّمَا رُزِقُوا مِنْهَا مِنْ ثَمَرَةٍ رِزْقًا قَالُوا هَذَا الَّذِي رُزِقْنَا مِنْ قَبْلُ وَأُتُوا بِهِ مُتَشَابِهًا. Whatever fruit, whatever provision, whatever blessing they receive there, they say, weren't we given these before? These are our actions coming back to us. God actually blessed us with these acts. We were given these before. They are given something similar in paradise. So in a way, God does not punish or reward. God just gives back to us who we are. This is you. Like it or don't like it. This is you. Now, so one is purity of the heart, which is created by these actions. The second thing which we take with this world, he says, is intimacy with God. Now, this is above purity of the heart. Purity of the heart is to do with us. Intimacy with God is when we have established a relationship with the source of beauty. Now, our acts, our heart may be beautiful. That person in our grave may be very beautiful, very lovable. However, intimacy with God is becoming close to the source of beauty. How this intimacy with God comes about? With remembrance of God. Zikrullah. So, actions, zikr of God, remembering Him all the time. And of course, when we do not remember God, we do not wrong Him. No one can wrong God. We wrong ourselves. If a student goes to university and doesn't study, they don't hurt anyone but themselves. Of course, their parents would be annoyed and upset. But eventually, it's them who will be sort of hurt by the consequences. If we do not remember God, we are in this world, this is our university, and the subject is knowing God. Isn't it? وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجَنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لَيَعْبُدُونَ أَيْ لَيَعْرِفُونَ Have not created jinn and ins but to worship me. And Imam said, it means to know me, because worship is our means to know Him. So you don't want to do? Okay, don't do. I advise you doing it. I advise you remember. يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اذْكُرُوا اللَّهَ ذِكْرًا كَثِيرًا O you who believe, remember God abundantly. But you don't want to do it. What can I do? I have provided everything for you. I have given everything to you. I have put myself at your disposal to know me, to love me, to become intimate with me. You don't want. What can I do? So, intimacy with God. The third thing, and intimacy comes with remembrance. Zikr. The third thing that we take from this dunya, he says, is love of God. That is even above all these things. Love. Now, not many of us would take this with us from this world. Only a few. I've mentioned this before. Some people worship God based on love. And these are muqarrabun. Some people worship God based on need. Based on faith. They believe in God, but they have needs. Either out of fear or out of for hope or whatever. These are Ashabul Yamin. Good. Very good. We do not condemn anyone. But they don't take love with them. And God knows when someone takes love from this world, love of God from this world, what would they expect there in the next world? We don't know. It's not imaginable. This world has a very limited capacity for our understanding of God, the concepts or whatever. The concepts about God, the concepts of paradise, the wisdom that we will receive in paradise. This world has a little capacity. So if someone takes this love with him, then he is not bothered about that person in the grave who is a very beautiful sort of creature, because he has a higher friend, has a higher love. It's God which is with him all the time, and God to whom he wanted to go all the time. So if dunya can provide us with these three things, is dunya good or bad? It's very good, isn't it? It's dunya balagh. This is dunya balagh. If dunya, instead of giving us these things, destroys us, destroy our soul, destroy our heart, we fill our heart, our soul, our mind only with this world, we are only concerned about it, then is this good or bad? It's very bad. It's mal'una, it's cursed. And here we find out about what Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq says الدنيا دنيان، دنيا بلاغ ودنيا ملؤونة. دنيا ملؤونة is when you spend yourself for this world. ألهاكم التكاثر. Wow. Seeking more and more of this world has diverted you from your purpose. ألها is when you are diverted from your purpose. ألهاكم التكاثر حتى زرتم المقابر. Until you meet the grave. Now there are two different explanations for this verse. حَتَّى زُرْتُمُ الْمَقَابِرِ. Many say that it means you are so immersed in seeking this world that you continue doing God until you die and meet the grave. You hit the grave. حَتَّى زُرْتُمُ الْمَقَابِرِ. There's another meaning for that, which is probably due to something which really has happened. Two tribes, Banu Sahm and Banu Abd Manaf, they were quarreling about who is more noble. Okay, they started to say, you see, we have this much and this much, this piece and that piece. They know we have more. Okay, but what about people? We have this noble person, that noble person, prominent people. I said, no, we have prominent people as well. One of them had more. They said, no, don't look at only the living people. Let's go and see how noble people we have under the soil, the dead people. So they went and counted the dead people. Oh my God, are you crazy? ألهاكم التكاثر حتى زرتم المقابر, to the extent that you go and talk about, you want to boast about those who are dead. And Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, Nahj al-Balagha, has an explanation of this verse. He says that instead of taking lesson from those who are under the grave, that how they have been fallen down, they boast about them. Hatta, this is how, this is the gharur. فَلَا يَغُرَّنَّكُمْ بِاللَّهِ الْغَرُورِ. Be careful, this world, this dunya is very deceptive. It deceives you to this extent. حَتَّى زُرْتُمُ الْمَقَابِرِ كَلَّا سَوْفَ تَعْلَمُونَ. Soon you will know after death. But this is only a small realization. After death, we will find more awareness. Believe me or not, after that is much better than here. But now you do not believe me, it doesn't matter. Inshallah, you will go and see after 100 years. But after death, we will have higher awareness. And that's why we will see things that we don't see now. We realize things that we do not realize now. So, kalla sawfa ta'lamun. A limited realization. Then when you are raised, your awareness is raised as well, is elevated, is lifted to a level which is not comparable at all to the understanding of even prophets in this world. It's raised very much. So again, kalla sawfa ta'lamun. Then after you will be raised, again you will know. Kalla law ta'lamuna ilma al-yaqeen. Had you had yaqeen, knowledge of yaqeen, certainty, لَتَرَوُنَّ الْجَحِيمِ, you would see the hell round you in this world, if we have yaqeen. We gather money, wealth, property around us by wronging others, by deceiving others, we are gathering hell around us. You would have seen this if you had ilm al-yaqeen. But soon you will find it in reality. أين اليقين. When we die, we see it in reality. أين اليقين. ثم لا ترونها أين اليقين. ثم لا تسألون يوم إذن عن النعيم. Then we'll ask you about dunya. What dunya you had. What sort of dunya you lived in. We'll ask you. Now imagine. How many more years are you going to live? I don't say, I don't reveal my age, but probably not more than 10 years. Not more than 10 years. No, really. I mean, okay, say 20 years, if God bless me. And then I'll become, وَمَن نُعَمِّرْهُ نُنَكِّسْهُ فِي الْخَالِ. Whoever we give long life, we return them in their creation to weakness, to disability, isn't it? What do I want to? 10 years is good. I thank God. If it goes over that, I move towards disability. Why should I want that? Isn't it? So, how many more years am I going to live? Everyone can, of course. You are old people, I'm young. Everyone can, of course, measure for themselves. That how many more years are we going to live? What use are we going to have for this life? For these years? These years, these remaining years are very important. In dua we have, make the best of our actions towards our end. Because it's the end which we are mature. We know better, we know more. We have to be free from greed. We have gradually pack up. Isn't it? Gradually we have to pack up. I mean, at this age, if I want to go build a palace for myself, people say that you are an idiot. This is the time that you have to pack up, not to sprawl yourself around. This is it. So we have to make the best use of this dunya. And this dunya is magnificent. Is magnificent. We cannot thank God enough for what He has given to us in this dunya. You know, someone was, because Amir al-Mu'min had become a caliph and they knew that Amir al-Mu'min always condemned dunya and such things, someone started to somehow eloquently talk bad about dunya in front of Amir al-Mu'min. Someone who was immersed in dunya. This dunya is such and such. Amir al-Mu'min slammed him. Keep quiet. Why do you talk bad about dunya? Dunya has not deceived you. You are deceived by dunya. Dunya is Daru Anbiya Allah, the place where all the prophets have come. The place where the human beings can go ascend towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is dunya. This is very good. But when we confuse, when we take end, means for end, then of course it becomes mal'una. Now, how many people during history, how many generations have been deceived by this dunya? See, if we ponder a little bit. And this example of Karbala is one of those very, very beautiful examples. Everyone knew that they were wrong in confronting Hussein Ali. Everyone knew that. And this dunya had deceived them. They took dunya as the end, and look what it would do to people when they take dunya as the end. Now tonight is night of Ashura, and I would like to, because tomorrow we are going to read Maqtal, but we wouldn't have time to read about night of Ashura. We only would have time to read about day of Ashura. So probably a little bit what happened on night of Ashura. I'll read from Maqtal. Of course, this is a translation of the Maqtal, somehow put in a different way to see what happened on that night. If you, of course, bless us with the salawat. Allahumma sallam. Towards the afternoon of today, Tasu'a day, night of Ashura. Towards the afternoon, the 30,000 strong army starts to mobilize. The right and left wings are formed, and cavalry and archers are put in line. The army looks formidable. Shemr, accompanied by a few horsemen, approaches Hussein's camp. Abbas looks on as a few of his men go forward to find out what is happening. Shemr and his company go and stand before the men, shouting, "Where are my nephews?" said Shemr. "I want to speak to my nephews." That is Abbas and his brothers, because from side of mother, they were related to the tribe of Shemr. The men from Hussein's camp turn back and look at Abbas. Shemr dismounts from his horse. Abbas's three brothers come out of their tent and join him, and together they go towards Shemr. The men from Hussein's camp go back and leave Abbas and his brothers to talk to Shemr privately. Shemr brings a letter out of his sleeve and brandishing it triumphantly in the air says, "My dear nephews, you are guaranteed security. This is your letter of immunity from Amir ibn Ziyad." Abbas replies, "God curse you and your letter of immunity. You offer us to be secure while the grandson of the Prophet is deprived of all security." They turn their backs and go. Shemr angrily throws the letter away, mounts his horse, and leaves. Umar ibn Sa'd and his commanders, sitting on their horses in full military attire, start commanding the army. The troops are poised to attack. Ibn Sa'd unsheathes his sword and shouts, "Troops of God, mount and rush to paradise." This is how they deceive themselves, that we are fighting a jihad against Hussein ibn Ali. There's uproar everywhere. Drums are beaten and trumpets are blown. The army moves forward. Hussein is sitting in front of his tent, dozing with his head resting on his knees. He holds the hilt of his sword, which is placed upright between his two knees. Hearing the clamor of the troops, Zainab rushes towards Hussein. "Brother," says Zainab, "don't you hear the sounds? They are coming." Hussein, not still completely awake, raises his head and looks at Zainab. Then he says calmly, "I just saw the messenger of God in my sleep. He told me, you are coming to us." Upon hearing that, Zainab slaps her face and cries out in grief. "You should not lament, my sister," says Hussein. "Calm down. God's mercy is on you." Zainab, not being able to control herself, leaves in tears. Hussein's men quickly come together. He puts them in order and calls Abbas. "My brother, Abbas, go and meet them and ask what they mean and why have they charged." "Yes, my lord," says Abbas, and rushes towards the troops with about 20 horsemen, among them some of the elders of Kufa, including Zuhair and Habib. Soon they meet a few commanders from Ibn Sa'd's army who are leading a vanguard dispatch, among them Shabath, son of Rab'i, who had written a letter inviting Hussein to come. "What has happened?" says Abbas. "Why have you charged?" Urwat ibn Qais, who's among the commanders of Ibn Sa'd, says, "The commander of Amir ibn Ziyad has arrived. You either surrender to his authority or we fight you." Abbas thinks for a while and then says, "Wait until I take this message to Hussein." "You better be quick about it," says Shabas. As Abbas leaves, the companions of Hussein start talking to the commanders of Ibn Sa'd. "Do you not realize what crime you are about to commit?" says Habib. Shabbat replies, "Do you not realize that resistance is futile?" Zuhair intervenes, "Do you really want to ask Hussein's grandfather to intercede for you on the day of judgment with the blood of Hussein on your hands?" Orwell replies, "If I were you, I would have persuaded Hussein to agree to pay allegiance to Yazid. In this way, he would save his own life and the life of his family." Habib replies, "You sell Hussein to Yazid." Orwa and Shabath cast their eyes down. Muhammad ibn Ash'as says, "We obey the rightful caliph and attain the grace of God through his hands." After a while, Abbas comes back. He says, panting, "Hussein wants the battle to be postponed until tomorrow." The commanders look at each other. "And what is the cause for that?" says Shabath. "He said," says Abbas, "he wants to worship and glorify his Lord for one more night. By God, since I've known him, nothing has been more pleasant for him than his night whisperings with his Lord." "We cannot grant that," says Shabbas. Orwa interjects, "Why not? If an army of disbelievers ever made such a request, he would have granted it." Shabbas hesitates. "We have to ask Umar ibn Sa'd." Abbas and his horsemen go back, and after a while, a messenger from Ibn Sa'd arrives. He goes to Hussein and shouts, "You are granted one more night. Should you surrender by tomorrow, we shall take you peacefully to Amir ibn Ziyad. But if you resist, you will be uprooted." The messenger leaves. Hussein looks at Abbas and says, "Call everyone. I want to talk to them." Hussein's companions all gather round him. Ali Zain al-Abidin, peace be on him, watches from the tent, but can only hear faint sounds. He struggles hard and comes out of his bed and with great hardship moves to get closer to the gathering. He gradually starts to discern the words, hearing his father's praise for the Lord. "We praise you in comfort and in pain," Hussein is praising. "You have honored us with your messenger and have taught us your book and have given us hearing, sight, and hearts, so place us among the thankful." He then looks at his companions and continues, "I know of no companions better and more loyal than you, nor of any house more pious and more close-knit than my house. May God reward you all on my behalf. I suppose this is the last day that we have with these people. However, they don't want anyone but me, so I permit all of you to leave. I have released you from the pledge you have given me. You can leave with no blame." I have some sort of suspicion that Hussein alayhi salam asked one more night, of course for worshipping, but for giving his companions who were hesitant more chance, that if they wanted to leave, they leave. So here he's offering them the opportunity. Tears flow down Ali Zainul Abidin's cheek. Hussein continues, "Night is falling around us. Take it as a cover and go." Abbas stands and replies with a choked voice and with tearful eyes, "Go. Go where? Shall we go to live on after you? May God never show us that day. We will never leave you, not before our blood is shed before yours." Aun and Ja'far, sons of Zainab, stand and say, "How could we go? How could we go on living after you, uncle?" And Ja'far continues, "What shall we say to our mother Zainab? if we leave you here in this desert alone with all these wolves surrounding you? Hussein turns to the brothers of Muslim, son of Aqil. Sons of Aqil, enough of your blood has already been shed. You have already proved your loyalty beyond any doubt. Your brother, Muslim, has been killed. So please leave now as I have permitted you. What would the people then tell us if we leave you? Say them that we deserted our Lord, our elder, and the son of our uncle, who was the best of uncles, that we did not shoot a single arrow with them, nor thrust a spear, nor strike a sword to protect them. No, we rather ransom you with our lives, property, and families, and we fight alongside you until we meet your destiny. How abominable life would be after you. Zuhair, from among the companions, stands up. My lord, your family have all spoken honorably, as is expected from them. By God, I would prefer to be killed and then recalled to life and then be killed 1,000 times in this manner, that in this way God should protect your life and the lives of these young men of your household. After him, Muslim ibn Awsaj arises and says with the same firmness and conviction, my lord, how should we excuse ourselves before God if we leave you alone? No, by God, I will stab them with my spear until it breaks. I will strike them with my sword so long as I can hold the hilt. If I have no weapon left to fight with them, I will throw stones at them. We will not leave you until God knows that we have preserved through you the honor of the Prophet in his absence. If I knew that I would die and then be revived, and then burnt, and then revived, and then scattered, and that would be done to me 70 times, I would have not left you before I met my death. So why should I leave you when it's only one death, and then the blessing to which there is no end? Silence prevails for a few moments. Hussein says, may God reward you all, but you should know that tomorrow, all of you will meet your death. Qasim, who is standing right beside his uncle, asks with concern, shall I meet my death as well, uncle? Because he's a child. Hussein looks at him kindly and says, how does death taste for you? Sweeter than honey, says Qasim. Hussein nods and pats him on his shoulder. Tears come to his eyes. Trying to hide them, he leaves quickly. Okay, this was some story about Night of Ashura. There's a very beautiful old Persian poem which is usually recited in Night of Ashura. I'll translate it for you. They say, those of you who know Persian, Emshab Shahadat Nome. امشب شهادت نامه عشاق امضا می شود. Tonight, the decree for the martyrdom of the lovers is signed. فردا ز خون عاشقان این دشت دریا می شود. Tomorrow, this plain will become an ocean from the blood of those lovers. و صلی الله علی محمد و آله الطاهرین.
كنتم صادقين ولا يتمنون أبدا. إن كنتم صادقين, if you're standing up for the truth, and when you look at from the two camps out there, I wonder, other than we know Hur transitioned, all right, was there anybody else, or was he the only one?
Apparently the only one, yeah.
The only soul that crossed the line. I'll open the floor for Q&A.
I'm a little confused with the doctor that spoke before. He said if you are, we approach people thinking that we are correct. And when the two comes together, we give a little bit of ourselves, in other words, and try to communicate. But if you don't think that you're correct, what is the point of it? You have to know that you are correct. And again, here with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the same thing happened. He knew he was correct, and he went into battle for that correctness. So I'm a little confused there. If you could shed some light there, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite fully understand your question. I think what you're saying, that if we say that we are correct, how can we convince others to be correct?
Not convincing, yeah. But having open dialogue.
Yes. Yeah, so you see, because each and every human being has got that fitrah. You know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Quran that each and every insan, each and every human being has got that fitrah. And it is ready, you know, to be actually attracted. You know, it is like the flame, you know. Or the example I like to give is, you know, like a needle. So a needle will always point towards north. You know, the compass needle will always point towards north. But if there is obstruction around, then the compass needle will move away, you know, from the north. So when we speak to people and we try to remove those obstructions which are ready to be removed because of the fitrah, so unless one person is, you know, takes the dunya as dunya malawniya, as Mawlana was actually saying, instead of dunya balagh, not balagh. You see, the word was balagh, which is good, you know, successful. So everybody is ready to actually get that. So if one is ready to get that, then through that fitrah, you know, we can remove the obstructions. And the way to do it is, you know, by our actions towards them and by actually reaching out. What I really meant was also that what we really need to do is, you know, reach out, you know, get outside of the four walls and, you know, really show people the true message of Imam Hussein. Does it answer your...
Sort of, but I'm still struggling with not fully knowing that you are correct. You know what you're going for. You are what you say you are.
I see. You are saying that, you know, that I have to be convinced myself that I'm correct.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you see, our aqidah, you know, everything that we heard today in today's majlis is the message of correctness. You know, correctness against not being correct. So if we take that message and we know, you know, for sure that we really truly believe that this world, you know, that this dunya is, you know, that, you know, although the dunya has been created for us, but we have been created for the akhirah. So if we know that well, and, you know, we are convinced about that, and we have got all these wonderful personalities, Imam Hussein, Imam, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, and all the Masumin alayhi salam, and, you know, the personality of Rasulullah himself, you know, knowing that fully, if we reach out, then I'm sure that, you know, those people are ready. You know, when I actually speak to the, you know, to the churches and to the synagogues, I get actually Christians, not so much in synagogues, but Christians actually come in front of me with tears in their eyes. And they say, "This is Islam? We did not know about this. Why don't you propagate it? Why don't you write in the newspapers?" So, you know, people are ready. So actually we have to appeal to those people. But my purpose also was, you know, to appeal Muslims at large, not only think that we are the only ones that are correct, you know. So this, you know, this thesis that, you know, that they don't believe in the Masumin al-Islam, you know, that thesis is wrong, and we need to correct that. You know, that's what I was trying to get at. Does that answer?
That's fair enough. Thank you.
Anybody else? Yes.
What I wanted to know was the seven principles of interaction that you were talking about. is the reference religious based? That means, is it from the Holy Quran or Hadith, or is this secular knowledge? That means sociological information. Yes.
It's from Hadith, of course.
It's from Hadith, okay.
It's from a Hadith in the book Misbah al-Sharia, which is quoted from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
Okay, yeah. Then is there any reference about humaneness in this reference?
Well, of course, all these are about humane behavior. And if by humane behavior you mean the way we have to interact with each other, then of course we had just one of those four sections of seven principles each was talking about the way we have to behave with each other, which we discussed last couple of nights.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Can we get a mic over here in the back, please?
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
In your explanation of our deeds after our death, which will accompany us in our grave, good deeds will be in form of a companion, good companion, and bad deed will be bad companion. My question is, a ayat from Surah Yasin, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Inna nahnu nuhyi al-mawta wa naktubu ma qaddamu wa atharahum wa kulla shayin ahsaynahu fi imam mubin. We are giving life to the dead wa naktubu ma qaddamu, and we are recording whatever their action. وآثارهم their footprints which they left behind. Now in that I understand that a good zuriyat, good children, or maybe a good knowledge, if I left in community or whatever, or school or madrasa, that I understand. My question is, to what extent the Fatiha which we are doing for our dead, or any good deed when a person died and he didn't do anything like charity or whatever, after my death, if I do niyaz, I make charity, to what extent that is accepted? Thank you.
Yeah, as you mentioned, atharahum is those relics that they leave behind and would continue to somehow benefit them after they die. You see, if we imagine that we have a life after death, and this life needs provisions, amenities, facilities, just like this world. Of course, it's all appropriate for that life, nothing like this life. We may be poor, may be rich. Some of us are rich there, some of us are poor. Some of us are in torment, some of us are in pleasure. Now, when we do fatiha and these things, what happens? A poor person becomes richer. It's just like gift you send them. A person which may be in torment will somehow be relieved of that torment. There is a beautiful hadith. I guess it is reported from Prophet Isa or our Prophet. I'm not sure now because I read this long time ago. That once he was passing by a grave and he did not stop on that grave, just passed quickly with his companions. Then he came back and he sat on the grave and did dua and recited the Fatiha. The companions asked, why did you do this? Because before you did not want to stop on this grave. After you have come back, you did what you did. He said, this man has left a child. This child, while we were going and coming back, went to school and learned to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And as soon as he said Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, this man was free from lots of his torments. Now, this hadith, we may not be able to authenticate it, but there are lots of hadith in this vein, that what we leave behind in terms of good deeds or good things which we leave behind may continue coming to us as we die. And our life would get richer, more comfortable, more pleasant. Or the evils that we leave behind may make us poorer, more discomfort for us, depending on what we have left behind us.
Yes, please.
Sorry. Dr. Bamanpour, your lectures in terms of the reason that we are in this world and the three things that you indicated that we will take with us, I am assuming that that all comes into full circle based on the relationship we have with God, ourselves, society, and everything. So in that, what my question is in terms of the interpretations that we have, that we think that we will go to heaven, for instance, our relationship with God, we have all these jurisprudence that we are supposed to follow. An example of it would be that some jurisprudence say that you shouldn't be eating from the hand of kafir. Some say that is okay. Another interpretation is you should not be attending a function where alcohol is served. Things like that, or an interpretation or a fatwa which says that children can be married off. This is what I've heard. I'm just giving you certain examples of it. When those come in to where you cannot reconcile yourself with your relationship with God because you don't know whether that is the correct interpretation of it, plus your interpretation in terms of the right and wrong. If we are right, somebody else is wrong. How do we reconcile that in our dealings with our society today and with the people around us?
Well, this question, of course, has several aspects. First of all, we have to know that God has created us for paradise. If we go to hell, it's going against His will. By will, I mean the legislative will, not the overall will, of course, because His will is that He should give us free will, and by our free will, we will choose where to go. But He doesn't like it. He doesn't like us to go to hell. Hell is created as sort of drainage of the dirt of creation. And this is what exactly is mentioned in Surah Anfal, that لَيَمِيزَ اللَّهُ الْخَبِيثَ مِنَ الطَّيِّبِ. God wants to separate clean from unclean, good from evil. وَيَجْعَلَ الْخَبِيثَ بَعْضَهَا عَلَى بَعْضٍ فَيَرْكُمَهُ جَمِيعًا. Then put evil on evil, compress it, فَيَجْعَلُهُ فِي جَهَنَّمْ. Put it in the hell, so that it would not pollute what is going to be the beauty of His creation. So this is secondary. We are all created for hell. As much as it is possible to separate evil from our soul, God will take care of that. If evil becomes part of our soul, then it's not possible to separate. Then we have to go to the process of hell or whatever. So the first thing I can say about your question is, إِن تَجْتَنِبُوا كَبَائِرَ مَا تُنْهَوْنَ عَنْهُ نُكَفِّرْ عَنْكُمْ سَيِّئَاتِكُمْ. If you avoid the grave sins that you are told not to go close to. Other bad deeds, we will forgive. We'll forgive, okay? So these petty things, if we do not intend to do bad things, evil sins, well, of course, every day, I mean, since morning this till evening, if you want to count how many slips we have, it's really difficult to count. Many, okay? But God says, don't worry about these small things. I will forgive. The main thing is that do not go close to those grave things that I've told you not to do. Killing people, committing zina, or doing things which you shouldn't do. Don't do that. And if sometimes inadvertently you are caught in a situation that you do that, still, if you repent, I will forgive that as well. الَّذِينَ يَجْتَنِبُونَ كَبَارَ الْإِثْمَ وَالْفَوَاحِشِ إِلَّا اللَّمَمْ. Those who avoid these big sins, except just slip in situation. I will forgive that. So one aspect of your question is that if we try to avoid the main prohibitions and to follow the main instructions of faith, the small things will be forgiven for us. However, we shouldn't let ourselves loose to go through these things, because then these things would lead us to great sins. So that we have to be careful. The second thing is that, okay, jurisprudence. Oh, we try our best to find a way to the correct instruction of faith, of religion. Now, suppose between me and Ahlul Sunnah, okay, they have a method for themselves. We have a method for ourselves. They try their best. I'm not talking about those people who intentionally deny or reject. Now, we know that this whole population of Ahlul Sunnah, in our belief, of course, it was a mistake at the beginning, but what is the fault of these people? They try their best to find the Sunnah of the Prophet. They try their best. Their efforts are appreciated. Our efforts are appreciated because we try our best to find the Sunnah of the Prophet. The efforts of our mujtahideen are appreciated because they are working to find out the best thing. However, we have to be careful. When we want to follow something, we should have a good proof why we are doing it. For example, if I say, I don't follow any mujtahid, I just follow my own, say for example, my own gut feeling about how I have to pray, what time I have to pray, this is not acceptable. You either have to know yourself, be expert yourself, or you say, okay, I'm not an expert, I don't have time, I don't have the knowledge, I rely on someone. Just like any other thing in this world. So we have to have a reasonable proof why we behave, they say, the way we behaved. And then we are exempt of any rebuke or whatever. But if we don't, then of course we will be questioned. Why? Why didn't you follow an expert? You say, God, I didn't know, for example, I had to fast, okay? Okay, you didn't know, you didn't read any book. What about those people who told you, knew and told you? Why didn't you follow them? This is how it works, I think. Does it answer your question?
Well, I think in jurisprudence there's a lot of things that tangle us as a community, so much so that we forget the other aspects of our relationships with our society and everything. That's where I'm coming.
Okay, I think we have to balance it overall. And jurisprudence is just an expert opinion about what we have to do. Now then, we have to arrange our relationships based on that expert opinion. If you think that you have a better understanding of situation and the sources, then you can follow it. Otherwise, as I said, whatever you do, eventually you should provide a proof why you behaved like that. And this is the most important thing. And that's why in the whole books of Usul, they say, for your actions, you need a hujjah. You need a proof why I behave like this. So if I am following a marja, for example, or jurisprudence, if God asks me, why did you behave like that? I say, because these were the experts, I refer to them. Now, what can God tell me? He cannot tell me anything, isn't it? But
was?
Yeah, my aql told me to follow the expert, isn't it? My aql tells me to follow an expert. Now, if I say, well, I had my own reasoning and I followed it, God says, okay, had you read the Quran and the Hadith and other sources? No, I hadn't. So, why do you say I did behave in this way? We have exactly one Hadith that's on the Day of Judgment, we are asked, Halla amiltum, why didn't you act? And people say, we didn't know. And then the angel replies, Halla ta'allamtum, why didn't you learn? So if we really think what the jurists say is not enough for our day-to-day life, then we have to take the pains and go and read the sources and bring a new sort of understanding of what is there. Otherwise, just blindly acting, I don't think it would be a good method for following Sharia.
I agree. Blindly following anything, it would be not a good thing. But one specific jurisprudence which I have a huge difficulty with is, and this is, I haven't verified it, so I don't know whether it is truth or not, but the concept that in a certain situation, a child can be married off, as in a minor child, like as in a six-month-old child or a two-year-old child, be married off.
Yeah. Do you want to do that to your child?
Well, no, my question is, the very fact that there is a fatwa that it can be done in a certain specific situation is what I cannot reconcile myself
to. This is a hypothetical thing. Usually, even if this is permissible to be done, it's not for marriage. It's to resolve certain relationships. I'm living with someone, for example, that I'm not mahram with. We want to have a more relaxed relationship with each other. Then this is sort of a family relationship by that is established. That's the only reason that this could be done. Otherwise, so you may say, I don't want to do it. It's not something that we have to follow in our life.
Thank you.
Just I want to let everybody know the kind courtesy of Haji Muhammad has made additional parking arrangements for tomorrow. The parking in the front, parking in the back, and he's also making arrangements to extend it if need be further up and down here. So there will be additional parking for tomorrow. I have a question. That's something that you kind of just flew right by at. You talked in great detail about the purity of the heart. You talk about intimacy of God, all right? Dhikr. The one area that I need a little bit more on, if you can help me, is the love of God.
Mm.
You just flew right by that.
Yeah, now that you say it, I realize I did. Yeah, he says love of God comes by knowledge. And that knowledge which we talked about, that ma'rifah which falls into the heart. How can you love someone that you do not know? It's not possible. We can, of course, our rational understanding, we see the signs of God, and therefore we have this feeling, this fitrah, that we have to fear God, that we have to believe in Him, follow His instructions. But because we don't know Him, we don't love Him. We only love Him when we know Him. And then, of course, he has talked before extensively about knowledge, how this ma'rifah knowledge comes to the heart. It's due to to purifying one's own self, practicing all the rules of akhlaq and worship, then knowledge gradually comes and love is created. You know, to the extent we know God, we are attracted to Him. Because God is absolute beauty, is absolute magnificence, majesty. So a glance at His face, so to speak, in, of course, in our own language, would somehow absorb people to itself. And therefore, the more we knowledge have, the more we have knowledge, the more we would love God.
See, the thing that where the crossroad is, would I find Him out of fear, or would I find Him out of love? This concept of taqwa you talk about, and you refer all the time as fear of God. And here He is, Rahman, He is Rahim. And then we go into who is Rahman for whom and who is Rahim for whom. All right? That's all the exegetes that use all the ink on papers.
Yeah.
But the concept, when you're looking at it here, that I'm looking for a little deeper clarifications, if I may. Will I find Him with love out of fear?
You know, love cannot be without fear. If you love your wife, you fear her. Really?
Now you get into fear, my house.
No. I tell you, you fear.
Here, by the way,
you fear to upset her. You fear out of concern. Now, about fear, I think we discussed. We love God because He's our Creator. We love God because He's beautiful, because He has Rahman, because He's Rahim. We fear Him because He's the judge, isn't it? That judge who's going to judge between us, we fear that. We fear Him because we are going to stand before Him one day and He's going to judge our actions. This is fear. And that's why wherever taqwa is mentioned, a sort of a ruling is given that do not transgress this. Do not do this. Ya ayyuha an-nabi ittaqillah wa la tuti' al-kafirin. So when you want to follow kafirin, fear God. You see, the fear comes when God is standing in position of a judge. But otherwise, of course, it's all love. These two cannot be separated from each other. God is sort of multifaceted being, and nabbi ibadi in Surah Hijr. This is very interesting. Nabbi ibadi, inform my servants, anni ana al-ghafur al-rahim. وَأَنَّ عَذَابِي هُوَ الْعَذَابُ الْعَلِيمُ.
But that,
it's not just that. It's not just that. If you want to wrong others, if you want to be selfish and want everything for yourself, then fear me because I'm the judge and I'm powerful and I can punish if you want to wrong others.
I think that comes to the laws of consequence. Yes?
Yeah, of course.
That's the laws of consequence.
Yeah, but everything,
so to me, when you look at, I would get more mileage if, more in being on a state of awareness, which is what really, awareness for the loss of love or connectivity, which is the quest in life, is to be connected with Allah, to lose that connection with Allah.
Mm. And now I tell you, you tell me, should these people who are somehow exploiting others, who are oppressing people and taking their rights, or those who, for example, kill people, should they fear God or should they love God? Shouldn't they fear God? They should fear God. And if they fear God, they don't do these things.
They're doing it.
Yeah. So because they don't fear, they do these things.
Because they don't know Him.
Yeah. They don't know Him, and of course they don't fear Him, isn't it? Now you didn't tell me whether you fear your wife or not.
Yes. There's a question from the lady's sister side, please.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
So there's so much violence in the world today, especially against Muslims, against Shias. We've also, some communities in the GTA, in the Toronto region, have experienced acts of violence and racism. Tomorrow is Ashura, the day of Ashura. Should these communities be more concerned about what could potentially happen and just play it safe and just, or is it, like I'm just saying, should they be careful in what they do tomorrow, or should they, is it their duty to continue to spread the message of Islam, of Hussein, as they would normally do?
You mean there's a danger out there for, if you want to?
I think there's some concern, just because of what they've experienced, what the communities have experienced.
Well, we always have to be cautious, of course, but also we should not be hindered in what we usually do and what we have to do. And in every community, whether Muslim, non-Muslim, when they are hit by some, for example, oppressive force, or they are wronged, you see, they say, life should go back to normal. We have to do what we used to do. We are not going to give in, for example. These are the things that usually they say. I remember several instances of terrorism which happened in London, the UK. Or, for example, their citizens were killed by ISIS in Iraq. This was what they said. Life should go to normal. We are not going to give in. We are going to continue based on our values. And this is what we have to do. But, of course, we shouldn't lose caution. We have to be cautious, but we continue, inshallah, what we have to do.
We get the mic over here, please. I think Haji Muhammad has, but the only thing is, he's asking, in order for him to articulate, he's going to ask it to you in Persian, and then you, if you would, translate the question to provide the response, please. I'll get you in a minute, please.
Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu
alaikum. زمانی که امام حسین علیه السلام به شهادت رسیدن در کتاب‌های اسلامی خواندیم که ما 3 روز اجازه داریم حضا داشته باشیم. آل ما چرا 10 روز پیش از شهادت امام حسین یا از کربلا چرا ما این حضاداری را قبل از شهادت حضا میگیریم، چرا بعدن نمیگیریم؟ و ضمناً اگر قبلاً برای آمادگی میگیریم که ما آماده اون روز جهاد باشیم که حمله کردن یزید، ما چی میدانستیم که امام حسین علیه السلام شاید در جبده غازی میشد، اون مشرکین به هلاکت میرساند، شاید اینا خودشان برنده اون جنگ میشدن، 700,000 اینا شاید با 40 نفر، با 72 نفر شاید به هلاکت میکشاندن. در اون زمان ما باید یک افتخار اسلام بود که ما برنده بودیم در اسلام. و چرا اینطوری؟
Okay.
تشکر.
The question has 2 parts. One part is that we have in Islamic literature that we are only allowed to keep 3 days of mourning for Imam Hussein. Why we keep 10 days of mourning? And and the second part, which this I'm going to join that to your second part of question, and why we do it before rather than after. Now we do 10 days before the Ashura, and how do we know that Imam Hussein was going to be defeated? Now that we are doing these 10 days, maybe at the 10th day Imam Hussein is victorious. Is this your question? Yeah. Well, I don't know about that literature that you are referring to, that we only have to keep mourning for 3 days. I haven't seen it anywhere. It may be a custom, I don't know. I mean, it depends on different people would have different customs, different attitudes towards these mourning and these things. We don't have anything like that. And secondly, these mournings are not for preparation for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. These majalis are just a commemoration. And commemoration, we can keep 10 days, 5 days, 20 days, as long as we think is useful. And of course, the first of Muharram was the, especially second of Muharram was the day when Imam Hussein entered Karbala, and it led gradually to escalation of situation. It led to the stoppage of water coming to the camps and these things. So these 10 hard days, we are somehow commemorating what was done. One thing we have to be to bear in mind about this movement of Imam Hussein is that Imam Hussein did not want to fight for power, especially after the Kufans reneged in their pledge. Now he wanted to go back. He didn't want to fight for power. He knew that it's not possible to win. And as we read in Maqtal Tonight, he said to his companions, tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. However, I'm not going to give in to these people, even if you are killed. It was not possible, of course. I mean, 70 people in front of 30,000 people, it was not possible. Thank you. So, thank you. So, this is commemoration. And it's nothing that would probably change the history, or we wait until this happens and then we do it. We have a hadith from Imam Reza alayhi salam, which talks about Muharram. And he says that my father, Imam Al-Kazim alayhi salam, when the beginning of, when the Muharram actually used to set in, he changed. He became very grieved. He was not the same person as before. And his grievance increased as we went closer and closer to the 10th day. And when the 10th day came, it was the yom, the day of his grief and mourning and crying. So this is probably custom coming from these sort of traditions, that from the first day of Muharram up to the 10th and then up to the 12th, of course, because of those 3 days that you mentioned, which is a custom, these things continue. Otherwise, there is no obligation. You can do it 1 day, 3 days, 10 days, before, after, as that.
Got a question here.
Wanted to add something. People see fear as opposite of love. Actually, the opposite of love is hate. It's not fear. And fear can generate love. How? If you are judged, let's say you're watching a movie and you see that a hero is executing judgment on the oppressors, then those who were oppressed, they feel a great deal of joy that somebody finally got this crooks. So it did generate love in the oppressed, but fear in the oppressor. Okay? So similarly, I don't think the day of judgment is only a day of fear. It's a day of great joy also. Because those who are oppressed in the world, justice will be done to them. And of course, they will feel a lot of love towards God that, wow, somebody was there to stand up to them. So fear does, judgment does generate love. They are not necessarily contradictory. Thank you.
True, true. I agree.
Is that why we fear our wives?
Well, it's a fear generates love. Yeah.
Dr. Mohsen, please.